Welcome to AMA Edgewise. I'm Dave Summers. AMA Edgewise is brought to you by the American Management Association. Our guests on today's program are Jim Collins and Morten Hansen. Jim is a student and teacher of enduring great companies, how they grow, how they attain superior performance, and how good companies can become great companies. He's authored or co-authored four books, including the classic Built to Last and the best-selling Good to Great. His work has been featured in Fortune, The Wall Street Journal, Business Week, Harvard Business Review, and Fast Company. Mort Hansen is a management professor at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information and at INSEAD, France. He was previously a professor at Harvard Business School. Prior to joining Harvard, Hansen obtained his doctorate from the Graduate School of Business at Stanford University. He's also been senior management consultant with the Boston Consulting Group. Jim and Morten are co-authors of the book Great by Choice, Uncertainty, Chaos, and Luck, Why Some Thrive Despite Them All. Gentlemen, welcome to Edgewise.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Jim, I'm wondering if you can give us just a little bit of background on the book.
It's very simple. It's to ask the question, why do some companies and their leaders thrive in the face of immense uncertainty and even episodes of chaos? Now, others do not.
And we quickly came to realize that we need to study companies that have done this. So we set out to identify those companies that had done exceptionally well over long periods of time over the last 30 years in industries that historically have been very chaotic, turbulent, uncertain, like the semiconductor industry or the airline industry. We started off with a data set of about 20,000 companies in the U.S. that had gone public over the last 30 years, so they were small when we picked them up. And from that, we winnowed down to find these seven exceptional companies.
Now, I'm just curious, did you overturn any of your earlier research?
We were not really setting out to either confirm or not confirm prior research. We just let the data take us where it takes us. Along the way, though, we tested all of the fundamental concepts from Built to Last and Good to Great. And what we found is those concepts still very much apply in these environments. The way I like to think of it is as a black box. Inside that box are the dynamics, the principles that distinguish a truly great company from others. And each study is like punching a hole and shining a light inside that black box. Now, in the Built to Last study, where we looked over 150 years, that's one light, and you see certain things. The Good to Great study looks at a whole different question of how do companies make a shift from good to great. Think of that as coming around on the other side of the box, and when you shine the light in there, the other things are still in there, but because it's a different angle, you're going to see some different things. And when you look through the lens of how the mighty fall, you're going to see yet other things. And then finally, this study becomes another lens. So the idea is that all the same principles are inside the black box, but each study is showing things that we weren't able to see before.
The lens that we are bringing here is how do you become great in an environment that is full of uncertainty and chaos, an extreme environment. It complements prior findings. And we're making this claim that that is going to be the next 50 years.
And you did indeed find differences.
Meaning, in other words, new ideas.
Exactly.
Yes, we did.
Yeah, I want to jump into one big idea, big finding for both of us, a fascinating insight. And we did not set out to prove anything here. This just spoke to us, and the data is very clear. It's the role of luck. We have great winners in industry that happen to jump so well because they were in the right place at the right time. How do you study that? We coded luck as events, either good or bad, start happening to you as you are navigating through your industry. They're unpredictable, they are potentially significant, and you cannot control them. And here is the finding. The winners were not more lucky than the average performers. They had the same number of good luck events, a number of bad luck events. So it cannot be luck itself that determines the winners in an industry. It has to be something else. It's what do you do with that luck?
Jim, what are your thoughts on that?
In large part because of Morten's insight about breaking it into a set of discrete events, we're able to study luck in a way that has methodological rigor to it. So you no longer think of it as this aura of good luck or aura of bad luck, but there's a series of events that you can analyze and then count, and you can look at their impact. For me, what's interesting about the luck analysis is that going through life, you have your plans and you have your approaches and you have the strategies you're going to employ. You need all those. But what we really need is this ability when something unexpected happens, something that might be a luck event, to zoom out and ask the question, what do I need to do differently or more intensely right now to get something out of this luck event? And so you have to recognize a luck event, and you have to then turn your attention to making the most out of the right luck event.
Mm-hmm. For instance?
When IBM was looking for an operating system, there were two companies that got approached. One of them was Microsoft, and one of them was another company that already had an advanced lead in operating systems. And what happened is IBM went to the company, and they didn't take the meeting very seriously. They didn't handle it very well. They didn't grab that opportunity and then make the most of it. Bill Gates, on the other hand, got the same stroke of luck. He recognized it and said, I wasn't planning to do an operating system, but it fits into the way we run our company. Let's do it. One had luck, but a low return. One had the same luck and got a great return. That is the difference.
In terms of luck, you have to be hypervigilant about what's going on around you and outside of your company so that you recognize the luck, both good and bad, when it comes to you. We call it productive paranoia. That paranoia, so to speak, is crucial, but it has to be productive. You can't just sit there and be worried about everything happening around you. You have to channel it into productive action. In a Bill Gates story, here's IBM calling, and Bill Gates is productive. He takes that opportunity and he channels his effort into making it happen. Had he not been very hypervigilant about what was going on around him, he would have just kept going on the path that he was on.
Right. And in the book, you've identified the different qualities of leadership.
Yes, there's a triad of behaviors that distinguish great leaders from others. One of those behaviors is fanatic discipline. One of those behaviors is empirical creativity. And one of those behaviors is productive paranoia, which Morton was just talking about. One of my favorite findings from the study is what we call the 20-mile march, which is a manifestation of fanatic discipline. In a world that's out of control or feels very uncertain, where you can feel frozen, where you feel like you can't move forward because you don't know what's coming, you have to find a way to exert control. You have to have something to focus on that allows you to keep making progress and to keep moving forward. All of our companies had a 20-mile march philosophy where they would achieve certain objectives, say, like marching 20 miles. If you were going to try to walk from San Diego to Maine, how do you do that? You don't, in good weather, do 50 miles, and then in bad weather, do zero. You do 20 miles a day, 20 miles a day, 20 miles a day.
Can you give us an example of that?
If you look at a company like Intel, doubling the number of components on a semiconductor chip every 12 to 18 months, which was Moore's Law, that was its 20-mile march. And it didn't matter whether it was an industry meltdown time or recession or boom times, always taking that systematic approach year in and year out. And that allowed them to have a point of focus, progress, calm, and clarity. And you put that together with return on luck.
What do you mean by that?
Gates never stopped marching. He just channeled it in a new direction, but the 20-mile march of iterations of software remained in place. Intel moved from memory chips to microprocessors, but the 20-mile march of Moore's Law stayed in place.
Got it. Now let's take a look at another issue, and that's innovation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course. What we found in this research was maybe the most innovative company won, maybe they didn't, but it was not a clear story one way or the other. One of the first that we analyzed was Southwest Airlines. And the way we do the research is we identify Southwest as this amazing performer in the airline industry, a very uncertain, chaotic environment. And then we asked the question, well, what airline was the comparison, the perfect twin for Southwest that started off in the same marathon way back in the 1960s with the same opportunities, the same conditions, and yet did not become great like Southwest Airlines? The company we picked is Pacific Southwest Airlines, PSA. They were dominating the California market up and down the corridor from Los Angeles and up to the Bay Area. Now, Southwest Airlines is considered the inventor of the commuter model, the bus and wing model. It turns out that Southwest copied the model from PSA, and PSA was the inventor. In fact, the people over at Southwest flew to San Diego to meet with the PSA people so that they could copy it. So then the question becomes, if Southwest Airlines was not the most innovative, how come they won and not PSA? So it cannot be that the most innovative company will be the greatest in uncertain and chaotic industries.
Innovation is important, but it's not by itself enough to make a great company.
And what did you find?
There's a threshold level of innovation that you have to even be in your industry. In the case of biotechnology, for example, that threshold is really high, because if you don't have patent-protected scientific breakthroughs that lead to new categories of products, you don't even survive. In the case of airlines, it's a relatively low threshold of innovation, and in, say, something like medical devices, it's somewhere in the middle. Once you are above the threshold of your industry, more innovation doesn't make you great. What you have to do is marry discipline to your creativity. So you take a company like Amgen, and it's often criticized for being too business-focused, but what it really is a very disciplined organization that allowed itself to be innovative enough, have enough patents, enough breakthroughs, but then marry a lot of discipline to those to make the most out of them. Now, what's the key thing? If somebody were to say, what we really need to do as a company is innovate, what do you do?
Okay. What's the answer to that one?
It's called fire bullets, then fire cannonballs.
Right.
So often things look like a big pioneering breakthrough. Somebody's had this great visionary idea and they just wowed the whole world with it. But it's not actually what happened. But what happened is they fired low cost, low risk, low distraction bullets, little steps, and they proved something. If you're trying to shoot at a target, if you put all your gunpowder in a cannon and you fire and it misses, you don't have any more gunpowder left. But if you fire a bunch of bullets until you get the line of sight right and then you fire the cannonball, you're more likely to hit the target. If you look at a company like Amgen coming up with EPO or Apple coming up with the iPod, Microsoft coming up with some of its later products, what you find is they often fired a lot of bullets to get something working, to prove that it would work, to get everything calibrated so that they could have confidence in it, then they would fire a big cannonball. The microprocessor did not start as some big, giant, new, innovative business area for Intel. It was a small bullet to solve a little problem of how do we make this chipset for a calculator. Over the years, they kept expanding beyond that till eventually it became what was Intel's primary business.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mort, do you have anything you want to add?
Absolutely. Some leaders might think for us to grow, we need to enter a new market, and we need to acquire a company, or we need to develop a new big product and fully commit right away. It has to be the next big thing. And that is a good way to get yourself killed. We call that an uncalibrated cannonball, because you're making a huge commitment, a huge investment, and you don't know if it's going to be a success. And it's a leadership skill to say, wait a minute, we're not going to do that. Let's hold back. Let's do the bullet first. Let's test it out. And go from there, then we have an empirical foundation, a track record. We know it's going to work. And then you make the big commitment.
And when you were monitoring the great companies, you saw that they changed less than other companies.
We started looking at these companies and how much change they engaged in, significant changes over time, going forward from their beginning and as they grew as a company. And the successful companies changed less. Now, you might say, well, that's because they were successful, so they didn't have to change later on. And that turned out not to be the case. Even when these companies, the winners versus the average performers, were both successful initially, the average performer started to change even when things were going well. So go back to Southwest Airlines versus PSA. Just when the deregulation happened in the airline industry, they were both in a good position to take advantage of that deregulation in the late 70s. Southwest Airlines looked at itself and said, we have a great model, let's make sure we hone it and we are prepared well for deregulation. PSA had a good model, and a leader said, there's so much change going on around us. We need to change too, from this little dingy commuter model to something professional, like, say, United Airlines, just a little cheaper. So they started changing their operations, and they made the crucial leadership mistake, which is, just because things are changing around you, doesn't mean you have to change. That did not work out well because they couldn't do it well, and so they started to fade. you have to look at yourself and say, do I have the right model for this environment? It doesn't mean that you don't have to change. It just means you have to be very careful about understanding what you need to change and when you need to change it, and not succumb to this herd mentality that says change all the time.
Okay, then I have a question. Are we looking at the future? Are we looking at the past? Are we looking at just time as always? From what you've been saying, I don't think this represents a major change. It's just what is.
You mean the level of uncertainty?
Yes.
The natural state of human affairs and the natural state of the world in which we operate is uncertainty and chaos and luck. That is history. That is the future. That is life. That's just what we have to live with. The last 50 years in some of the more advanced economies created, in a sense, an artificial sense of stability. We were in a world that might have been very dangerous with two superpowers pointing weapons at each other and so forth, but it felt pretty stable relative to what we feel today. When you're inside that protective cocoon and you have that almost unprecedented rising prosperity that we had, you can tend to believe that that's normal. But in history, that's not normal. There are very few times in history that you get to grow up inside a dominant global superpower during an era of almost unprecedented rising prosperity with no threats on your direct borders. Of course, it's happened in history. You have the Roman Empire, 500 BCE Greece, certain times of the Egyptian Old Kingdom, certain times in China. But they are more rare slices of history. We happen to get one of those rare slices of history. But that's not normal. Here's the key point. That's not bad. It's just like gravity. I don't walk around every day and say, gosh, it's terrible, there's gravity. It's gravity. And you learn to live with gravity. You learn to operate with gravity. You learn to live with uncertainty. You learn to operate in uncertainty. Our friends who have been in places like Brazil and India and China and other parts of the world have been living with this for a very long time, and they're very good at it. We can be good at it, too.
And the implication for a business leader and manager is the world that we are in is one of uncertainty and perhaps even chaos, and it's not going to go away. So we need a set of management skills and leadership principles that are good for that kind of environment.
All right. And to conclude, one last question. Do you have anything additional you'd like to comment on?
I would like to mention one of the great stories we have and how we came upon it, because I'm Norwegian, and you will notice in the book that we talk about the great Norwegian Roald Amundsen, who was the first person to get to the South Pole. Of course, when I grew up in Norway, we knew about Roald Amundsen and the details of his great accomplishment. So when Jim and I were doing this research, somebody Jim spoke to said, you keep on talking about these leadership skills. They remind me a lot about this Amundsen character. So Jim calls me up and says, do you know somebody called Amundsen? And I said, what do you mean? It's a great Norwegian hero. Of course.
That's a terrific
one.
So
we started studying Amundsen in detail, exactly what he did. And what we found was Amundsen was so much like our leaders of these great companies. And moreover, Captain Scott on the British team was very similar to the comparison company CEOs. And of course, if you are the expedition leader trying to be the first person to reach the South Pole, you are in an extreme environment. You're going into the unknown. You don't know what is ahead of you. There are no maps. There's no communication. There's no planes flying over. It's an unknown. And I think it's a great metaphor for the business world. We're going into the unknown. You better be prepared and you better have these leadership skills in place. Otherwise, you are not going to succeed.
We've been speaking to Jim Collins and Morten Hansen, co-authors of the book Great by Choice, Uncertainty, Chaos, and Luck, Why Some Thrive Despite Them All. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us today on Edgewise.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Dave.
Follow the American Management Association on Twitter to learn about upcoming free programs, the latest news, management insights, and special offers. You can follow us at AMANET. That's AMANET. Hope to tweet to you real soon. We'd love to get your feedback on today's program. You can either email us at podcast@amanet.org or call 800-697-3406. Your comments may become part of a future program. Thanks for taking us along. I'm Dave Summers, and you've been listening to AMA's Edgewise.